Once again, in the book of Ruth. In fact, this will be our last Sunday in the book of Ruth, for the time being at least. We should be able to finish up chapter 4 today. And so we now come to the climax and the resolution of this wonderful story of Ruth. Remember that the theme of the book is how God demonstrates his faithfulness, his kindness, his loving kindness toward us by superintending and caring for his people. Chapter 4 shows how God provides a home and security for Naomi and Ruth. God demonstrates his chesed, that wonderful Hebrew word that means loving kindness or mercy. God demonstrates that to those who follow his word, who live in virtue and honor. During the time of the judges, when so many other people were doing whatever they felt like doing, whatever was right in their own eyes, we have a couple of people, Boaz and Ruth, who lived according to godly biblical moral standards, and God blessed them for that. God approved of their behavior, and God blessed them, in particular Naomi and Ruth, by giving them security and a home and a family. We live in a time much like that of the judges. Many people around us simply do whatever they feel like doing. There's no moral constraints. They simply do what is right in their own eyes, much like the people of the time of the judges. After reading the book of Ruth, we should be assured that God blesses those who live virtuous, honorable, responsible lives. Any sincere Christian, I suppose, wants to enjoy God's blessing on his or her life. And this story shows how, if we live virtuous, honorable, responsible lives, we can expect God to bless us. Now, we don't expect exactly the same set of circumstances. If you are a single person looking for a mate, maybe God will bless you in that way, but probably not in the same way that he did with Ruth and Boaz here. But I think in general terms, if we live a godly, honorable, responsible kind of a lifestyle, then we can expect God to bless us and take care of us. This is a book that shows God's care for his people, especially when they're living godly, virtuous, honorable lives. And so we can expect that God will provide for us like he did for these people through his providence, through his goodness, through opportunities, and through circumstances. God provides for those who love him and serve him and live an honorable lifestyle. Now remember the context here. We just jumped into chapter 4, but I'm assuming that we all are kind of up to speed with the story up to this point. Ruth, we find out in chapter 3, had gone to the threshing floor and laid herself down there at the foot of Boaz, uncovered his feet, and he woke up. He found her there. And then Ruth utters these very important words. She said, "Spread your skirt or your wing over your handmaiden." Now what she was basically doing there was asking Boaz to marry her. Boaz was the goel. He was a near kinsman who had a biblical responsibility to take care of people in the family who had come upon hard times. And so Boaz then agrees to do that. Of course, eventually Ruth goes back home and she tells the story to Naomi. And Naomi says, "Sit still and wait to see what will happen," because Boaz is the kind of guy who's going to try to bring this situation to a conclusion as soon as possible. So we come to chapter 4 then, and I've called this message Boaz Takes Charge, because now the ball is in Boaz's court. He knows that Ruth wants to be married to him. He knows what he has to do, and so he starts making preparation now for basically fulfilling Ruth's request. It seems like Boaz is interested in Ruth, but Ruth kind of takes the initiative to invite him to marry her, and Boaz seems to be on board with that. He wants to do it. And so now he has to go through a few hoops. He has to jump a few hurdles to fulfill Ruth's request and make Ruth his wife. And so this is what we find in chapter 4. First of all, Boaz approaches the nearer kinsman at the city gate. We read about that in chapter 4, verse 1. "Boaz went up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom he spake came by, unto whom he said, 'Ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here,' and he turned aside and sat down." So this all occurs at the city gate, in our day at least. If you're doing a transaction like this, a financial transaction or a realty situation, typically we would go to maybe a bank or a realty office or maybe a lawyer's office, and this kind of thing, these kinds of transactions would not happen in the city gate. I mean, do we have a city gate in Antigo? I don't think we do. But in those days, gated cities were very common, and the people of the city, especially the prominent people, the important people, or the leading members of that city, would be stationed at the gate, and that's where they did their business. That's where business transactions like this were, you know, processed. So that's what happened. Boaz goes to the city gate, and lo and behold, the man who's the nearer kinsman is there. And so Boaz pulls him aside, sits him down, and then he takes about 10 of these other people from the city and has them sit down as witnesses. Now we see the hand of God's providence, once again, very evident in this case, because Boaz goes to the city gate trying to find this person who's the nearer kinsman, who has the first right. He's nearer in his family relationships to Ruth's former husband, who has died. And so he has the right to play the role of the goel. And so Boaz has to approach this man to see if he wants to do this job, because really, he's a closer relative than Boaz himself is. So he has the first rights of refusal, and so Boaz checks with this man to see what he wants to do. He has these other people sit down as well, because they need witnesses to this transfer of wealth and transfer of property. So Boaz wants to make sure that this is done legally. He wants it to be done publicly. He doesn't want something to happen in the future to come back and say, no, wait a second, you didn't do this the right way. There's some other claims, there's some other, you know, arrangement that maybe has been made. No, he wants this done publicly, above board. He wants everybody to see what's going on. So he has, it says here, 10 other people sit down and witness what's going to happen. And so Boaz then explains the situation in verse 3. He said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. Now, brother doesn't necessarily mean, you know, blood brother. The idea would be relative. Elimelech, of course, was Naomi's deceased husband, the father of Ruth's deceased husband. And so Naomi now is in control of the estate. Typically speaking, a woman would not be in control of the estate, but she's the only one left of Elimelech's family. So she is in charge of the estate, and it turns out that it says, according to what Boaz says here, she has a parcel of land to sell. Now, this is the first time in the story that we've heard about this parcel of land to be sold, but it makes a lot of sense here, because according to the Old Testament law, one way that you could get out of debt or to take care of yourself was to sell your property. It turns out that there was still some property that belonged to Elimelech and hence belonged to Naomi. And because Naomi now has no means of support, right? She's a widow. She apparently can't even go out into the fields to glean. Ruth has been doing that for her. So how is she going to get by? She's got nothing. She's got no means of income. So it would make sense for her, if she had property, to sell it. Now the thing is, in the Old Testament, you couldn't exactly just sell your property. If you remember what the law says in the Old Testament, you could lease out your property to somebody, but only for how many years? 50 years. And then there was supposed to be the year of Jubilee, which all the property was to revert to its original owners. So you weren't supposed to sell your land. You could lease it out temporarily, but you weren't supposed to sell it. The only time you could really sell it was in a situation like this with Naomi, because she had no heirs. Her husband was dead and her two sons were dead. She had no heirs. So if you could sell the property to somebody in that case, you would actually be able to buy the land and keep it permanently, because the original owners no longer were available, or they had to sell it to get, you know, the money out of it. In this situation, Naomi could sell the property, but it would go to a goel. It would go to another member of the family, hopefully, who could then keep it, you might say, for the next heir to come along. Well, let me read a quote that kind of describes this a little bit. One of the writers said, land sold for debt relief could also be redeemed at any time by the seller or his goel. So let's say Naomi wanted to sell this property, but eventually she gets out of debt, she has some money, she could get the property back. So whenever you had a situation, if you sold the property, eventually the original owners could get it back if there was somebody still in that line, in that family line. But so as long as Elimelech had no heirs, the property that he and Naomi had sold to pay their debts would automatically become the permanent possession of anyone who acted as Naomi's goel by redeeming her property. So in this case, another person who bought this, the goel, the near kinsman, would actually be able to keep that property because Naomi's line was ended after her. As soon as Naomi died, there was no other heir to take control of that property. So in that case, if somebody bought that property, the goel would be the person to do so. That would be somebody in the family, but it would not be the original owners of that land. At least the land would be kept in the property or in the ownership of the general overall family. But in Naomi's case, as soon as she died, since she has no heirs, then she has no control over that property, and whoever bought it then keeps it permanently. Boaz here displays tremendous integrity and honesty. He could have kind of rigged the system and gone around this nearer kinsman to marry Ruth if he really wanted to. He didn't necessarily have to go about this in a very public way, even informing this other goel, this other nearer kinsman. He didn't really have to inform him. He could have, if he really wanted to, he could have done kind of an underhanded thing, went ahead and married Ruth, bought this property just for himself, without even giving this other guy the opportunity to buy it. So the fact that he does, the fact that he's now deferring what's going to happen to him, his desire to have Ruth as his wife, all depends upon this other kinsman now. And if Boaz were not a man of honesty and virtue, he would have just gotten what he wanted for himself and not worried about this other guy. But the fact that he does, the fact that he goes to this man and really defers to his decision and says, you're the nearer kinsman, what do you want to do? Do you want to buy this property? It really shows Boaz's integrity. When a person is willing to defer to the rights of somebody else, it says a lot about his character. It's the rare person who will suffer personal loss because he's honest. Boaz, in this case, is willing to suffer loss, the idea that now he couldn't marry Ruth. He's willing to do that if the other person is willing to buy this property. He's honest, he's virtuous, and that sort of puts his desires at risk. He's willing to suffer loss, you might say, because of his honesty. And that, to me, is a Christian virtue. Sometimes we have to, or we are in a situation where if we are going to be honest, we are going to suffer loss. And a Christian person, a virtuous person, is one who says, well, I made this agreement, or these are the circumstances that pertain, and if I'm going to be honest, I'm going to suffer loss in this situation. And this is where a Christian person, a person of virtue, simply has to say, well, that's life. Sometimes if we're going to be honest, if we're going to have virtue and integrity, we will suffer loss potentially. It's going to cost us something. Psalm 15:4 mentions a person who swears to his own hurt and does not change. There are times in life when we make an agreement and it works out to our hurt. It works out to our cost. It works out that it's not beneficial. And there are times when we might feel like, I'm going to try to rig the system. I'm going to try to do something underhanded, do something a little shady so it does not end up being costly. But a person like Boaz, a person with virtue, he says, no, this is the right way to do it. And even if it costs me, even if I can't have what I want, I'm willing to do that because I need to be honest. I need to be virtuous in this decision. And so Boaz is a man like that, of virtue and honor. Somebody put it this way, a good man will have everything done with perfect openness and honor and will stand by the result, whether it fulfills his hopes or disappoints them. So to me, that's a mark of honesty. It's a mark of integrity when you can say, I'm going to do things openly and with virtue and honor, and the outcome, I'm just going to live with the outcome. It might not be beneficial to me, but that's okay. I need to be honest, and whatever my business dealings are, I'm going to be full of virtue and integrity. And Boaz was a person like that. Well, notice what happens then in verse 4, continuing with Boaz. He says, I thought to advertise thee, or tell you about it, in other words, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee. In other words, this was the nearer kinsman. He was a nearer relative to Elimelech or to Ruth's former husband. And he said, verse 4 at the very end, he said, I will redeem it. Now, we don't have a lot of detail here about exactly how Boaz felt about that, but you can imagine the sinking feeling in Boaz's heart potentially here when he hears that this other guy is going to redeem it, thinking that, okay, Ruth is part of this package deal, and if you're going to buy the property, you're also going to get Ruth. And so he perhaps now feels like, oh, no, this is not going to work out. This other guy's going to redeem the property, and this other guy's going to take Ruth. But notice verse 5, then Boaz said, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must also of Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. So Boaz then mentions a catch here. There's a little detail you should be aware of, that if you're going to buy this property, you're also, in a sense, purchasing Ruth as your wife. He explained that part of the responsibility of the purchaser in this case is levirate marriage. Now, I've mentioned the idea of levirate marriage before. The kinsman redeemer, this nearer kinsman, levir is the brother-in-law, but it means a relative, who would come and who would raise up seed for the dead man, this person who has died, Ruth's husband has died. And so the idea was that the nearer kinsman would come along, marry the widow, and then the first boy, the first male child born of that union, would then be considered the son of the dead man. So that would keep the inheritance in the family. That would mean that that little boy would inherit everything that his father, his dead father, owned, or in this case, even his grandfather. Elimelech's entire inheritance then would go to this little boy who would be born of the union of the Goel, or the Levir, in this case, the kinsman redeemer, and Ruth. So he mentions that that's the way that it's got to be. You are playing the role of the Goel, and you're also playing the role of the Levir, the levirate marriage person, okay? So what does the fellow say? He says, upon hearing this, he decides not to. Notice he goes back in verse 6, the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar my own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. So there's certain things, we don't know exactly the details in this man's life, but he says, if I were to do this, it would mar my own inheritance. So it seems pretty likely here that the man is already married. He probably has enough children to feed. And, you know, it would be a good deal to buy this property if he didn't have to mess with Ruth, because again, if he bought this property, it would be his permanently. He wouldn't have to worry about other heirs. He could get that land permanently, which normally speaking, like I said, you can't buy other land permanently. So it would be a good deal for anybody willing to buy that land, because then he'd have more land for himself. But the idea of taking Ruth along with that, he says, no, that would mar my own inheritance. He's probably already married. He probably already has kids. He probably doesn't want all the red tape that would go along with marrying Ruth, because then the child that is born to Ruth would not be considered his own child. It would be considered the child, or the inheritance would come then through Elimelech's family and Mahlon, and that child would be considered somebody else's child, essentially. So he doesn't want to deal with that. He's not interested in having another wife and having more children to feed, and so he basically says, no, I'm going to pass. I will not redeem this land. Interestingly, the Old Testament law was very harsh on a goel who refused to do his duty. This man was the nearest kinsman, and it fell upon him to marry Ruth and raise up seed for Ruth's dead husband. That was his responsibility. That was his duty. In fact, Deuteronomy 25 proclaims a curse on such a person who knows his job is the goel and does not do it. And even the people of the gate, they should have risen up in offense and say, now wait a second, you are the goel, you are the nearer kinsman, you must do this job. But I think the fact that Boaz is kind of waiting in the wings to say, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. Probably the people of the gate said, well, as long as somebody does it, it's going to be okay. If the nearer kinsman can't do it, well, then Boaz can do it, and that's fine. So the nearer kinsman, by all rights, should have done it, but the fact that Boaz was there as the next in line, that was going to work out all right as well. So notice what happens next. Kind of an odd ceremony goes on here. Verse 7, this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing, for to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe, or his sandal, I guess, probably to be more specific there, and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore, the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. Now that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if we didn't have verse 7. Buy it for thee, here's my shoe. What are you talking about? Well, in former times, apparently that's how they did it. We don't have a real explanation of how this developed. As I was reading the different commentaries, there were a lot of different ideas about the significance of drawing off your shoe, but we really don't know. So it was just the ceremony. It was just the way they did it back in the old days. So then, secondly, the second major thing that happens here in our outline, at least, number 2, Boaz confirms publicly his purchase of Ruth. So verse 9, Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Notice verse 10, moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have purchased to be my wife. Now, for those of you who are, you know, newlyweds, you probably don't describe your wedding to your wife as, I have purchased this woman for myself. But essentially, that's kind of how it worked. So Boaz affirms at the gate that to all these witnesses that he has now purchased everything. We don't, again, know all the details or how it all worked out, what exactly was done here. But he's witnessing or he's telling the people, okay, we're going to go through with this transaction. So he would be fulfilling the duty of the goel by buying the property, and he'd be fulfilling the duty of Levirate marriage by marrying the widow. So again, he's raising up seed. In fact, that's what he says in verse 10, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day. So his intent then is that the first male child born of his union with Ruth would be thought of as the son of Mahlon, not his own. Now, no doubt, they had more children than the one, but this one, first male child to be born, would inherit everything from Elimelech's estate. And so Boaz would be sort of the stepfather, you might say, of this child, and the child would be recognized to be the inheritance, have the inheritance of Ruth's former husband. Boaz was careful to do all this publicly, with many witnesses around. This is all legally done. This is all public and above board. There's nothing shady going on here. He wants everybody to see this, as that's why he says, ye are witnesses this day. So he wants everybody to know what's going on. This is not done in a shady or underhanded way. And this again shows that Boaz has real integrity. He's a businessman. He's a man who has wealth and who has property, but he's doing everything in a publicly proper way. He's doing things according to the book in an honest and forthright way. He's a virtuous, honorable man. And that's how we ought to do business as well. I don't know all the business dealings of all the different people here, but you know, it can be a temptation to do shady and improper, perhaps even illegal or deceitful business practices. And that's really not what Christians ought to be involved with. We ought to be living a life of honesty and integrity, and that ought to affect our business dealings as well. I've just been reading a book recently about a very prominent political family, and throughout the book they mention these shady and sketchy and underhanded business deals one after the other that are part of this political family. And it's just very disheartening to read about the underhanded business practices of a so-called highly esteemed, highly exalted, a very powerful political family. And these are people who claim to be Christians. Christians ought not to be behaving themselves that kind of a way, especially in their business transactions. Well, the text doesn't mention it here, but I think Boaz must have paid the money for the property. He probably had some deeds drawn up. Everything, again, is happening publicly. They had deeds at this time. They would drop the deed. They would pay the money. They probably would make copies of it. They probably put it up in storage of some sort or put it up in some sort of a archive. This was all done very carefully and according to tradition. And in verse 11, all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman like Rachel and Leah. So we are witnesses of these things. All the people there say, we understand what's happening. We are willing to show that we are witnesses. We see what's happening here. And then the people pronounce a blessing on Boaz, wishing that Ruth would become fruitful like Rachel and Leah. Notice the language here. The Lord make the woman that is come into thine house like Rachel and Leah, which too did build the house of Israel. Now remember, Ruth is not a Jewess. Ruth is a Moabite. And Moab was a perennial enemy of Israel. And so for these people to say, may this woman, Ruth, this Moabitess, be like Rachel and Leah. I mean, Rachel and Leah were the very mothers of Israel. So for them to say, may this Moabite be like the mothers of Israel, is just a very gracious expression. It's almost like, we don't even care that she's a Moabite. That's fine. She's just such a wonderful girl. We wish your family all the happiness in the world. We're very grateful and we're happy to be part of this situation. Well, why do you suppose the people of Bethlehem became so supportive of Ruth? They didn't know her. She came from Moab back with Naomi. She's only been there a few months. Why in the world are people so happy that Ruth and Boaz are going to get married? Well, I think it's because Ruth has shown herself to be a godly, virtuous, helpful, kind, loving woman. Everybody has seen how Ruth has been out there gleaning, taking care of Naomi. Probably she interacted with other people, and she has just a wonderful reputation. Everybody knows that Ruth is friendly and loving and kind and welcoming. And everybody's happy that this good thing now has happened to Boaz and to Ruth. How do we, you know, as the old book says, how do we make friends and influence people? How can we be people who others are supportive of? How can we live the kind of life that when something good happens, everybody is really happy about that? Well, we live virtuous lives. We live lives of integrity. We live lives of responsibility. We do what God calls upon us to do. We are people like this, people of character, people who love others and support others and care for others, people who honor God by the way that we live. That's the way that we can become people like Ruth and Boaz. And then finally this morning, Boaz and Ruth are married and have a son. So, verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife, and when he went unto her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. So they get married, and they bear a son. Now, we, again, could wish for more details here. It simply says, Boaz took Ruth as his wife. Now, you wonder, did they have a ceremony? You know, did they have a regular marriage? How did they do things back there? Or did maybe Boaz just came home from the city gate and said, okay, Ruth, honey, we're married. You know, how did it happen back then? We don't really know. But somehow they were married in the normal, traditional way, we assume here. And they set up housing together. In verse 14, the women of the place said, blessed be the Lord, which has not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. The women confer this blessing and prayers for prosperity on Naomi. And then we see from this description how much value the culture placed on children. Notice verse 15. He, this child, shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life and a nourisher of thy old age. You know what the word for old age is there in that case? The Hebrew is gray hair. So, of course, most of us, as we age, our hair gets gray, or in some cases it falls out. And so may this child be a nourisher in your old age, when you have your gray hair. For thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, again, there you see the idea. Everybody could see that Ruth loved Naomi. She has chesed. She has loyalty. She has faithfulness. And that's why they're very happy about this arrangement. That loveth thee, which is better to thee than seven sons. I mean, the best thing that a Hebrew person could think of for their family is to have seven sons. For the people here to say, she's better to you than seven sons, that's saying a lot. Ruth had a very high, very good reputation among the people there at Bethlehem, and that's why everybody's so happy about this. Verse 16, Naomi took the child and laid it on her bosom, and she became a nurse unto it. She became the child, the one responsible for child care for this child. And so I think, again, we see within the Hebrew culture, within the Jews, a very high regard for children. Would you say that our culture has a high regard for children? No. It's unfortunate. We live in the culture of death, where if people are unwanted, they can just be killed. And of course, we know that's true with abortion. We know that's true with how people treat their children today and even their old people in their community. We see here that the biblical responsibility is that the parents care for the children, and then when the parents become old-aged, that the children care for their parents. And so I think we see the importance of the family relationship here. And unfortunately, there are many people today who don't care about their children, and then the children don't care about their parents. And we wonder why there's so much chaos and so much instability in our culture today. It's largely because the family has been destroyed in many cases. There's really not that those family ties that hold families together like there should be, like there would be if people would follow the biblical pattern. Naomi then becomes the caregiver of the child. It seems as if, I think we can assume that Naomi came to live in Boaz's home. She's caring for the child, and of course Ruth is the mother, so I think clearly she's living there with them in their home. Remember that Boaz was a wealthy, influential man. So I imagine that he provided a fairly nice, a fairly pleasant place to live for his home and family. Remember, Naomi earlier in the book had called herself Mara. She had gone out, she had left Bethlehem full, and she'd come back empty. She said that the hand of the Lord was against me. Well, what's happening now at the end of her life, or in her senior years, now she is full again. Now she has a little baby to take care of. Now she has a home. She has security. She has somebody to take care of her. And so everything has kind of reversed itself. God has shown himself very good, very kind to Naomi. Although Naomi faced some truly difficult times, God has provided abundantly for her, primarily through Ruth. Remember at the beginning of the story, after, you know, Naomi's husband and the two sons had died, Naomi wanted to go back to Bethlehem by herself. But Ruth persisted, and she ended up coming back with her. Imagine if Naomi had come back without Ruth. All these blessings, the gleaning, and eventually becoming a grandmother again, eventually becoming a part of Boaz's family, all that depends on who? Ruth. If it weren't for Ruth, Naomi would be this bitter old woman, probably poverty-stricken, having to sell her property, having nobody to take care of her. She probably would have died early. But instead of that, because Ruth is there, she enjoys the senior years of her life, taking care of her, you know, little grandbaby, and enjoying life in Boaz's home. So Ruth has been a real blessing to Naomi, and I'm sure that Naomi appreciated that. So as we approach the end of the story, we can almost say they all lived happily ever after. This is one of those rare cases in the Bible where we find a really wonderful story where everything works out just fine in the end. Given what we know about the personal character of Ruth and Boaz, we can assume that their home was really a wonderful place. Probably Obed and his siblings enjoyed a warm and loving family atmosphere. They named the child Obed, which is probably short for Obadiah. Obed is based on the Hebrew word for servant. Obadiah is servant of the Lord, and so that seems to be what his name is here. Then the narrator gives us some details regarding the genealogy of Boaz's family, and it's probable that the entire story was given or written to give us this information at the very end. This information at the end is probably the point of the whole story. And so we have this genealogy, and, you know, typically speaking, we sort of just skip through the genealogies. We don't put a whole lot of emphasis on those. But notice the end of the genealogy, of course, in verse 22. Obed begat Jesse. We are familiar with him if you know the Bible. And Jesse begat David. So the whole purpose of this is to show some very important, very interesting details in the life of King David. And generally speaking, when you have a genealogy like that, the person at the end of the line is the one that they're saying something about. So this was probably written, probably produced or published around the time that King David was assuming the throne as the king. So this is a story designed to support David as the king. And if you're aware of your Bible history, you know that there was a lot of conflict involved in the transition from Saul to David as the king. So this is probably published, probably by permission of David, to show just some interesting background on David as the king, and it would be designed to promote or to encourage people to, you know, think well of David as the new king. These details are important not only because it talks about King David, but also because David is in the genealogical line of whom? Jesus, of course. Jesus is of the tribe and the line of Judah. And, of course, David is the king that is in that line as well. So in David's family line, there's a Moabitess, a woman who's not even Jewish. And that means that in the line of Jesus, there's a Moabitess woman, which again shows the grace of God. God is gracious and kind in recognizing people who come to, you know, trust under the shadow of his wing, whether they are Hebrew people or not. Well, I thought it'd be good then to just go through some things we learned from the book of Ruth as we kind of close things up and review a little bit. What are the main lessons that we learned from the book of Ruth? Let me just kind of highlight a few of these. First of all, we can say that God is full of chesed. That's that wonderful Hebrew word that means loving kindness and mercy. He delights in blessing those who behave themselves with godly virtue and honor. God is love. God delights in blessing. God delights in showing kindness and mercy to those who follow him. God accepts those who put their faith in him. Even foreigners and idolaters like Ruth can be saved by seeking refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. Remember, that's the language that we see throughout the book of Ruth, to shelter under one's wings or to come to live under the shadow of God's wings. You know, when she said, spread your wing over your handmaid, same idea, come under the protective care and guidance. And so Ruth is an example of someone who's a convert to the God of Israel. The grace of God is evident throughout the book. And of course, we believe that is a very important attribute of God. God's grace, God's loving kindness, his mercy toward us. God is working out his providential plan in our lives. Many have recognized that the chief actor in this whole drama is God. God is not mentioned too many times here, but clearly, providentially speaking, he is in the background, moving these characters, putting the right person in the right place at the right time to make sure that these people enjoy the blessings of God. And so we see God providentially working out his plan in the lives of these faithful people. God cares for his people. Even though Naomi and Ruth were at the point in time where they were just gleaning the barley, and, you know, we may get to the point in our lives where we are living off the gleanings. That may be true, but still God provides for his people. Those who are faithful, those who are virtuous, those who obey him, God provides for them. God can bring good out of bad. Naomi had good reason, remember, to be bitter. She had gone out full and returned empty. The hand of the Lord, she said, was against her. But it was the hand of the Lord that brought her back to Bethlehem and provided a home and a family for her. When things looked really bleak, God provided a spark of hope. And so God can provide solutions to his people who serve and follow him. We trust that God is providentially working in our lives behind the scenes to provide options, to provide resources for us. Even when things look bad, we trust God to work things out for his glory and for our good. God rewards personal character and godly living. Boaz and Ruth, I think, exemplify honorable, godly, responsible behavior in the time of the judges, a very chaotic and ungodly time in the history of Israel. And they are blessed because of that. God takes care of them. God blesses them because of their faithfulness to him. In fact, everyone who reads the story of Ruth benefits from the godly examples of Ruth and Boaz. And finally, good character and virtue in one generation have an influence that extend down the years. The history of Israel depends upon the covenant faithfulness of Boaz and Ruth. If this story hadn't happened, we wouldn't have a King David. So it's their faithfulness, it's their honesty, it's their integrity that leads to the outcome for the nation of Israel. Our personal character, likewise, can have influence for generations to come. The book of Ruth is one of those rare biblical stories with a truly happy ending. The book presents us with godly, realistic characters whose example we can follow. All of us should seek to be people of virtue and character like Boaz and Ruth. We should be kind, gracious, and virtuous people. Above all, we should have confidence that God demonstrates his faithfulness by loving, superintending, and caring for his people. And since God is so kind and generous and gracious to us, we should respond by obeying his word and being kind and generous to others. Well, let's close in prayer.